German wrote about the elephant in the battle plans of Ashurbanipal in the 8th century BC as a major tank force. And the Frenchman wrote about the mating and loving qualities of the elephant. And the Englishman wrote about the significance of the elephant in the economy of the Indian Raj in the 19th century. And the Jew wrote on the elephant and the Jewish problem. China has been in the news. We've opened diplomatic, we're about to open diplomatic relations with China, and so I speak to you in China and the Jewish problem. And the other thing that I must add before we begin is that I speak Chinese with an Ashkenazic accent. And so I make no pretense at the appropriate pronunciation of various of our ancestors who will appear in the course of this story. Most of us think of China as a nation set apart, a culture which is self-consistent, unique, which has been apart from the development of civilization in the rest of the world, which has lived on itself and in the process developed a high level of civilization, which is unique, Chinese. The scientific word is autochthonous. I suppose for most of us, the image of China is that of the Great Wall, this massive land barrier erected by the Chinese to keep the alien, the barbarian, or the foreign devil out. And the Chinese, of course, believe in the uniqueness of their civilization. It's almost an article of faith. During most of the pre-modern centuries, China not only closed its doors to foreign settlement, but to foreign trade as well. And when most of us read Marco Polo when we were children, we remember the fact that he could stay only 11 months in China. That was the length of his visa, and that was an extended visa. Foreigners could come for a specific purpose, and then they had to leave. And during this 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, there were not even foreign traders in China. And finally, in the middle of the 19th century, Russia, Europe, and the United States fought an opium war, as it was called, in order to force the Chinese at least to trade with the West. And at the end of that war, they carved out special zones in the coastal cities, in the legation quarter in Peking, which their armies held and which gave them an outpost in China for purposes of trade. But still the empire, the Manchu Empire, refused to allow these Western traders to go into the hinterland, to spread throughout China. And then around the beginning of this century, there was the Great Boxer Rebellion, which was a populist rebellion to drive out the foreign devil. It seems as if it's only in our generation, really, that, in fact, in the last several weeks, that China has wanted to open up to the West, because Mao's China was certainly closed. Mao believed in a China which was self-subsistent, which would provide all of the learning, the science, the technology, the agriculture, the food, technological advancement which any nation needed. And yet such an image of China, like most generalizations, is a false one. From earliest days, China has been open to influences from the outside. Archaeologists in China, working in Neolithic sites, have found several kinds of pottery, which they name after type sites. One's called Yangshao and one's called Lungshan. One is a painted striped pottery and one is a blackware. And they know that the prototypes of these two kinds of pottery are in Asia Minor, in the Caspian Sea area and in Persia. That the first pottery made in China was imported, was modeled after imports from the West. And certainly one of the great religious traditions of China, Buddhism, came in over the Himalayas from India and was significant in China for millennia. And finally, in the Middle Ages, There were sizable Christian, Muslim, and Jewish settlements throughout China. And these settlements were not only those of foreign traders, but these were natives. Families who were integrated within the Chinese economy, whose sons, if they were talented, passed the examinations in the classics and gained significant roles in the Chinese civil service and bureaucracy. We know of one Jewish community in China, at Kaifengfu, which I'll talk about in a minute, whose synagogue existed for over 700 years. And the synagogue was not a small place. It was the size of two football fields put together. So China has been open to the West, to the South, foreign influence for many years, for many centuries, since the very beginning of its history. But such is the depth of Chinese culture, and such is the separation, the geographic separation of China from the world, the Pacific Ocean, the Himalayas, the Great Gobi Desert, the wastelands of Siberia. And such is the racial composition of China that China takes in influences and then absorbs them and makes them her own so that they seem wholly native and wholly natural. And we lose any sense of what is in fact the case, the composite nature of Chinese culture. It is not simply native. It is homogeneous, but originally heterogeneous. And we can see that in our own century. Maoism is Marxism, borrowing from the West. The technology, the science that China is so avidly seeking, she must borrow from the West. That's why she is opening her doors to our corporate people and to our engineers and to our diplomatic leaders. But one thing we must also notice is that having absorbed what she wants from someplace else, China closes the door. When the Buddhists came in the 3rd and 4th centuries before the Common Era, they established great monasteries. They were a major force in Chinese society. There were tens of millions of Chinese Buddhists. And then in the 8th century of this era, the Chinese government moved against the great Buddhist monasteries and stripped them of their land and stripped the Buddhists of their power and in a sense drove them underground. So they became secret societies rather than open societies. And when in the 12th century the Chinese wanted to drive out the Greek and Armenian and Persian Christians who had established large communities, they did so. Maoism is Marxism, but it's Chinese Marxism, and they have turned their backs on Lenin and on Russia, the parent country from which their ideology is borrowed. Which I guess is to suggest that in time the doors that are opening now will be closed again. For the history of China is of a country which really does want to be isolated, the Middle Kingdom, a world unto itself, and is quite consciously and deliberately opens its doors when it wants something, when it needs something to revivify its culture, to strengthen its economy, and then closes the door again when it has gained what it thinks it needed. So if you're going to go to China, make your trip in the next few years. Now what about the Jewish community of China? The earliest records of Jews in China are silent records. You can see them in many museums. If you look in those cases which display the Tang pottery, those wonderful Tang horses and human figures, which were originally funerary figures buried with the dead, you'll find among the many hundreds of different types of music girls, of mandarins, of soldiers, of charioteers, you'll find a number of pottery figures who are drawn from the great caravans which moved across the Silk Route, which led from China above or below the Gobi Desert across the top of India through Afghanistan and down into Persia, and from there either to Arabia or to the Mediterranean coast and into Egypt. You'll see the camels, which were the great beasts of burden, and you'll see the traders. They wear the short coats, usually of dark colors, and their cast of faces is purely Semitic. And these figures are either the figures of Persian Christians or of Persian Muslims or of Persian Jews. Because these three groups, Shiite Muslims, Nestorian Christians, and Persian Jews, dominated the trade along this route. The Chinese didn't send out their traders, they allowed the traders of the West to come in. And among the most significant of these groups were the Jews of Persia, from Samarkand and Bukhara and Isfahan. They came, they took this long journey year in and year out. And about 50 years ago, an explorer who was rummaging around in one of the temples in Khotan, which is in Chinese Turkestan, in the far west portion of China, just where the desert ends and China begins, found among a number of documents relating to this trade, two documents from the year 718. One, a Judeo-Persian business document, that is a document written in Hebrew letters, but in Persian language, essentially, about a business dealing related to this trade route. And the other, a little Hebrew prayer, which had been folded this way and this way, obviously to carry it above a man's heart as a good luck charm for the journey. So there were traders on this land route, led from Persia into China. Now the first permanent settlement of Jews that we know of in China dates from the 10th or the 11th century, from what is called the Sung period. During those years, the city of Kaifengfu, which is a Yellow River city about 450 miles southwest of Peking, a low city built of mud brick, a city which from time and again is destroyed by floods of the Yellow River. The city of Kaifengfu was among the greatest cities of the world and was the capital of the Sung Empire. It was a city of 1.5 million people in the 10th century. It was a city in which there were 16 square miles within the city walls. It was a city in which there was a significant Jewish population. How do we know this? We know this because in Kaifengfu to this day, there are three tall, 5 to 7 feet high stone tablets, inscribed, of course, in Chinese, which describe the foundation and the history of the synagogue of Kaifengfu, or at least of this particular synagogue, which was established in the year 1163. One of the tablets dates from the 14th century, one from the 15th century, and one from the mid-16th century. And they describe a synagogue which is 350 feet long, 250 feet wide, whose architecture is not so much simply a boxed-in space like our modern synagogues, but rather more like the synagogues of the East, that is of Persia and of India, synagogues which look like mosques. A walled-in area, the forecourt of which is an open plaza, a number of plazas leading one to the other, each plaza separated from the other by a great Chinese gateway arch. And then at the far end, that is, in the western end of this great space, is the synagogue building itself. Terraced, steps leading up, longer than it is deep, built in typical Chinese fashion, that is, latticed rice paper walls, a beautiful floor, black lacquer pillars holding up a two-story high tiled ceiling. This is the synagogue of Kaifengfu. And over the door of the from the street, there was in the Chinese characters of the time the phrase, the temple of truth and purity, which seems to have been the designation in China for both a mosque and a synagogue. Because to the Chinese, the worship of any worship of the great spirit of God, which was separated from idols, from icons, from images, was identified with each other. And the Jews, as a matter of fact, were often called in China the blue-hatted Muslims. Because in Jewish worship in China, they didn't wear a yarmulke. Or what they wore was a blue turban with a blue ribbon that went down the back over a ceremonial robe. The Muslims wore a white turban with a white ribbon. And the Jews wore a light blue turban. And the leader of the service wore this blue turban, the blue ribbon, a ceremonial robe, and blue sandals. And this was the fashion in which he led the service. Now, the synagogue of Kaifeng Fu, which was established in 1163, went through a number of serious rebuildings. It was flooded out in the 12th century, was destroyed by fire in the 13th century, was flooded out twice in the 14th century. It was destroyed by a flood in the middle of the 17th century, but it was rebuilt each time by the Jewish community. And we have two or three designs of the synagogue drawn for us by Jesuit priests, missionaries, who went into Kaifeng Fu in the early part of the 18th century, and who have left us what we know of the design of the synagogue. They drew it for us. And what you would have seen, what I would have seen, had we been able to pass through the various courts to the court in front of the synagogue building itself, would have been to the right a great fountain where the Jews would have washed their hands and their feet before they entered the synagogue building itself. The three freestanding pillars describing the foundation of the synagogue. And then you would have walked into the synagogue building itself through a stepped terrace. And as you walked into the synagogue, you would have noticed first a long, narrow table. And on that table would have been a bronze censer, two simple flower pots, and then two candlesticks. And this is a traditional symbol of a shrine in China. And behind this table, you would have seen on one of the pillars, one of these black, tall, thin, wood lacquer pillars, you would have seen a wood plaque with the writing being the rescript of the emperor, the emperor's name, the authorization for the shrine to be in existence, the protection of the shrine. Such a plaque was featured in every shrine in China, and traditionally one had to make obeisance to the emperor as one entered to do worship. This presented for the Jews obviously a problem. How did one bow, kowtow to the emperor if one faced, you know, had the second commandment staring one in the face? So they solved the problem. On the pillar was the plaque with the emperor's name to which they were to make obeisance, and above it was another plaque. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Leolam Vaed. No English translation. So that when they bowed to the emperor, they were really bowing to God. And behind the emperor's plaque, there was an area which was fenced off with a low, open-fretted lacquer wood fence, within which there was a low table in mahogany and a much higher chair, which was called the Moshi Paozo. That's my Ashkenazic Chinese, which means simply the chair of Moses. And on this chair, they would place the Sefer Torah when they would read from it. And one of these Jesuits has left us a line drawing of this act of reading from the Torah. They didn't take the Torah out as we do, that is simply in a cloth mantle, and then open it and read it on a desk. The Torah was encased in a simple lacquer wood case, and it was never taken out of the case. The case was opened, and one man stood at the side of the reader, and he turned the Torah to the portion, and the reader stood, now he's blue turbaned, blue ribbon, ceremony robe, hands at his sides, which was apparently an act of reverence, and he would read from the script. There was no yad, there was no pointer. He would simply read out. And over here was a man who would stand with a book. Not a scroll, but a book. Each book had one of the sections to be read in successive weeks in the Torah. And the book had the letters and the vowels. And if the reader made a mistake, the corrector corrected his mistake. And we still have copies of these 53 little books, not all of them, of course, with a punctuation in them to make sure that the Chinese reader would read the Torah correctly. Some of these have survived. Now, the act seems familiar, and it is familiar except for one thing, that when the man read from the Torah, he placed in front of him, in front of his turban, a thin silk veil, and he read the Torah through the veil. We don't understand why. It probably had something to do with the fact that this was a holy book. The radiance of the holiness shone forth. He was protecting his face from the the glory, the divinity of the book itself, but that's a guess. No one knows. But the reader was veiled, as opposed to the way we read a Torah today. And then if you proceeded further back into this shrine, you would have come upon a dark shadowed area, which was in a sense their Holy of Holies. And there they kept a beautifully worked hexagonal wooden box, which was their ark. And in the ark they kept 13 Torahs, 12 representing apparently each of the 12 tribes, and one the Torah of Moses himself. And these 13 Torahs, which survived at least to the flood of 1642, were the pride and joy of the synagogue. Now, how had these Jews come to China? The Chinese called them the sect that came from India. And the records of these stone tablets indicate that those 70 clans that came originally, who settled in Kaifengfu, had brought with them the cotton industry. The manufacture of cotton had been imported in the 10th and 11th centuries by the Sung emperors from India into China. And the Jews had apparently been among those who were brought into China to teach the Chinese how to carry out this industry, which became a very basic part of their economy. And so very early we have this community. We know of other synagogues which no longer exist, even in picture form, in Hangzhou, in Peking, and elsewhere. The Jewish community was spread through central China of some size, beginning in at least the 12th century and probably several centuries earlier. Now we know that this group practiced circumcision, that they kept the Sabbath, that they had some form of the dietary laws because they were also known as the people who plucked the sinew, that their worship was in Hebrew, that it was chanted, that no musical instruments accompanied the worship. And most interesting of all, we know that these people had both a Chinese name and a Chinese personality and a Hebrew name and a Hebrew personality. There's a little book of 67 pages which somehow survived from this community, which is now in the library of the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. I've seen it. It's a register of names from the synagogue of Kaifengfu. There are about 700, 800 names in it. And what's fascinating is that the Chinese names are written from top to bottom, and across the Chinese names they've written the Hebrew name, when a Hebrew name was known. And because the Chinese kept very careful gazetteers and registers of their people, particularly of those who passed the examinations and who gained public employment, we can correlate a number of these Chinese names with people who are known from the gazetteers, the Chinese gazetteers, for significant activity within the Chinese polity and the Chinese economy. For instance, there's a man by the name of Cao Xian. His Hebrew name is Mordecai ben Yosef. Now, Mordecai ben Yosef lived in the middle of the 17th century. As a Hebrew, we know that when the great flood struck in 1642, which destroyed most of the town and the synagogue, he fled with his family across the Yellow River to safety. The flood had been precipitated by a bandit attack on the town. A bandit warlord had attacked Kaifengfu, besieged it for a number of months. Finally, when he couldn't take the town in his anger, he had broken the dikes which protected the town from the river. And so when the people not only had to flee the flood, they had to flee from the bandit. The bandit invested the town for loot after he flooded the town. Well, we know that Mordecai ben Yosef was told by his father, because the Hebrew tablet tells us this, to go back into town, to go back into the synagogue, and to save the Sefer Torahs, which were caught in the flood, which had been damaged by the flood, but these were their sacred books, and Mordecai ben Yosef was to do this heroic act. We don't know anything of this from the Chinese gazetteer, but we know from the Chinese gazetteer that Mordecai ben Yosef, as Cao Xian, passed a degree of competency in the Chinese classics as only one of 24 in the whole town in the mid part of the 17th century, and gained significant employment as one of the sub-governors of the province of Honan, of which Kaifengfu is part. And from this ability to check between Jewish personalities and Chinese personalities, the fact that, just as we have a synagogue personality and we have some Jewish interests and we have interests in the larger community,
We're able to tell a great deal about the socioeconomic levels of this community and about the way in which they assimilated to the Chinese culture. We know, for instance, that a number of these men rose to positions of prominence. There were several who were governors of provinces, several who were chiefs of various kinds of circuit courts. One was a superintendent of the sacred rites in Peking. One was an ambassador from Honan to Sichuan province. Another was a gentleman of the robe, whatever that meant within the Chinese economy. That most of these people were agriculturalists and craftsmen and artisans, but some were generals, and some were intelligentsia, masters of Mencius and Confucius and the nine classics and the rest of the Chinese way of life. So that, like, the same as we, they lived in several worlds, and they made, as best they could, an adjustment between these worlds. And to suggest to you the kind of adjustment they made, let me read a translation of part of one of the tablets. This is from the 16th century, which will show you what they knew of their own tradition, what they picked up from the Chinese tradition, and what they were proud of, because this obviously was a memorial tablet set out for all to see. The founder of our religion is Abraham, who is thus the ancestor of the religion. After him, Moses, who transmitted the scriptures, is thus the master, the Shifa of the religion. Then the same religion from the time of the Han Dynasty entered and established itself in the Middle Kingdom, which is China. Under the Sung Emperor, Xiao, in the year 1163, the first year of the Lungxiang period, an ancestral temple was built in Kaifeng. In the 16th year of the Yuan Dynasty, in the year 1279, the synagogue of the ancient temple was rebuilt so there might be a place where the scriptures could be worthily venerated. The adherents of this religion are found not only in Kaifeng, but in many places in the Middle Kingdom. And all who are under heaven are adherents of the religion, and there is none who does not venerate the scriptures or honor the way, the Tao. Again, a word borrowed from the Chinese. Although the written characters of the Torah of this religion are different from the script of Confucian books, yet in examining their principles, the Chinese word li, it is found that their Tao, their way, is one that is common to the Chinese way. And they use throughout the word Tao, which means way in China, which is the word which has to do with one's whole ethical, personal, moral stature, is very much like the word halakha, the word, the Hebrew way, the halakhic way of our people. This is the way, this is why when the Tao, the way, reigns between father and son, the father extends loving kindness and the son responds with filial love. When the Tao reigns between prince and minister, the prince is benevolent and the minister is reverential. When the Tao reigns between brothers, the elder is friendly and the younger respectful. When the Tao, or the halakha, reigns between married couples, the husband is conciliatory and the wife is complacent. Women's lib and did not come to China until the 20th century. When the Tao reigns between friends, they were mutually helpful and faithful. In the Tao, in the way, there is nothing greater than love and righteousness. And when these are put into practice, the feelings of commiseration, the feelings of shame and dislike will be the natural results. And that's a quote from one of the classics. In the Tao, there is nothing greater than propriety and wisdom, chokhmah, li, qi. And when they are put into practice, the feelings of modesty and complacence and the feelings of approving and disapproving will be the natural results. When men follow the Tao in their fastings or purifications, they necessarily show themselves dignified and respectful. When men follow the Tao in the sacrifices to the ancestors, they necessarily show themselves filial and sincere. Concerning widows and widowers and orphans and childless old men and the lame and infirm of every sort, there is nothing that is not succored and relieved by compassion so that no one becomes shelterless. And on and on and on. The identity of two great moral and religious traditions. Now, what happened to this Chinese Jewish community? It lasted down to our times. But it lasted as a group and as an effective body, that is, a body which was conscious of its traditions, aware of the substance of the Jewish way, really only until the late 18th century. Kaifeng fell into bad times. China lost its sense of being a unified nation. Kaifeng was out of the way of the new economy and fell into, it was, became an impoverished center. There were many reasons, not the least of which is the question of numbers. There is a point below which A small diaspora community cannot survive. It has to intermarry in order to survive, and ultimately there are simply not enough people, men or women, for the community to sustain itself. And the fewer people there are, the less likely it will be that there will be those who will train themselves specifically to be the masters, to be the rabbis, to be those who can educate the next generation in the traditions. And so after the 17th century, as the city became impoverished, as the country began to break up, as the numbers, which were probably originally something on the order of 25 or 30,000 in Kaifeng, began to diminish, this community began to lose its control of its own sources. And by the time that the Anglican Bishop of Toronto took over the missionary's set up his missionary headquarters in Kaifeng around the year 1880, though there were about 500 Chinese in the town who knew themselves to be Jews, they knew nothing about their Judaism. They could no longer read the Torah, which was in their possession. They remembered only that their grandparents had told them something about Moses, something about a distant and faraway past. The synagogue itself lasted till about 1850. And then these people, having become impoverished, sold the synagogue, sold the land, sold the buildings, sold the tiles, sold the fountains, sold the carvings for food in order to have the ability to survive. A number of the implements of the synagogue found their way into the local mosque. A number were purchased by the Anglican bishop from Toronto, who brought them back to the Royal Ontario Museum in Canada, where they remain to this day. There is a box, which was once a Sefer Torah, in the Royal Ontario Museum from Kaifeng Fu. There are several column heads from the synagogue in the Royal Ontario Museum. And there are a number of the sacred books from the synagogue, which are also in that museum. So impoverished did this community become that they sold not only the place, which was once a synagogue, but they sold the ground itself. Kaifeng Fu is a very low city on a riverbank. There's no stone there. Everything is of mud brick. And when there are the sandstorms come in from this countryside, so much waste is deposited upon the city that the level of the city rises. And in order for the buildings to remain at street level, the buildings must constantly be shored up. And so they actually dug up the courtyards, the topsoil of the courtyards, and sold it around the town. And so by the 1870s and 1880s, you had nothing but a hole in the ground, which was filled with water, which became one of the places in which the women of the town came to do their laundry. And when the Anglican bishop from Toronto describes his first visit to the synagogue, which he'd heard about and sought after, he describes going to this swamp in the middle of Kaifeng Fu, and seeing there in the middle of the swamp these two stone tablets, which were still there with the Chinese characters, but seeing the water buffalo drinking from the water and the women doing their laundry where once the Jews had worshipped. The Jewish community of China was never that large, but it had a long and proud history. And it died out only in the 19th century, died out as an effective instrument only in the 19th century. But even as it was dying out, a new group of Jews was coming into China. These were Jews who were coming from Persia through India. They were coming by the sea route and not the land route. They settled in the port cities of Shanghai and of Hong Kong and even slightly inland in Canton. The leading families were the Sassoons, the Kaduris, Persian families who made great wealth in the 18th and 19th century by their factoring, by their commerce, and by their trade. They had been forced out of Persia by the anti-Semitic policies of the Shiite Muslim caliphs, the recrudescence of which we're seeing in our own day. And they found an opportunity to move with the expansion of British and French commercial interests into the coast cities of all of Asia. They established in the mid-19th century their own synagogues. The synagogue of Shanghai, the synagogue of Hong Kong were established around 1850. And they have, at least in Hong Kong, the synagogue has remained in operation till our day. The numbers were never large, a few thousand in each city. And then at the end of the 19th century, a new generation began to come into China from Russia. They came after the Russo-Japanese War because it was the era of commercial expansion in Manchuria. The They came to help build the railroads because they could escape this way from the pogroms. Some escaped then after the Communist Revolution in 1917. They established themselves in Harbin and other cities in Manchuria. They came down into Shanghai, and they began to prosper there beginning around 1900. They remained in Manchuria till about 1931 with the Japanese invasion. And then these people moved down into Shanghai and Hong Kong and Canton, and they remained in these until the beginning of the war. About 20,000 German refugees found their ways into the community. They were interned during the war. They were impoverished, they were put into camps, but they were not physically harmed in any significant way. And then most of these got out of China late in the 40s, early in the 50s, some to America, most to Israel. And so the only community of Jews who remain in China, remain in Hong Kong. We can call that China, and it's a very small community, if a community at all. A wonderful story, unrelated to anything else, but it's heartwarming, so I give it to you. In 1953, when I was a chaplain in Japan, a young man came to me who was a pilot who used to fly what we call a mail run between our base in Japan, Formosa, Hong Kong, and the Philippines. He'd been in the Far East for about 18 months, and he told me that he made a regular stop in Hong Kong. He'd met there a lovely girl. They wanted to be married, and they had to be married at an American base for purposes of citizenship. Would I marry them? And I said I would be delighted to, and we set a date. And then I thought to myself, you know, she's going to be 1,200 miles from home, and he's about 5,000 miles from home. I'd love to see if we can't warm this ceremony up a bit. They were going to be married around noon. So I asked one of the young officers and his wife on the base if they would arrange a luncheon after the wedding. We'd invite a few people, and that we'd at least have the sense of other Jews at the Simcha. They came, and they were married, and we came back to the house for the lunch. And the man who was the officer whose home the lunch was taking place, and the girl, the bride, began to talk. And the more they talked, the more their faces lit up, and the closer they became, because it turned out that they were second cousins. When his family had moved, as so many of our families did, from Russia, from the pogroms, to New York, her family, from the same little town, from the same mishpacha, had moved to Trans-Siberia, to Harbin, and then down to Hong Kong. And so we had a reunion as well as a wedding the same day. Which I guess is to say that we Jews, though small in number, manage to find each other wherever we may be. We're all one mishpacha. And we've been in many places, strange and exotic, if you will, and wondrous places. The moral of the story? Have many children. Because a Jewish community which is not of size will not survive. Amen.